Hey. Huh? About that, huh?
Excuse me?
Will you recognize me?
No.
Come on, 20 years ago.
What?
18th Street?
I don't know what you're talking
about.
Give
me your money.
Where's
your wallet?
Hey, hello, and welcome to The Place to Be, a Seinfeld podcast. I'm your host, Adam.
And I'm Eric.
On today's episode, we welcome Alan Wasserman. Alan has appeared in a number of films and TV shows, including Big, The Office, Arrested Development, The Sopranos, Boston Legal, The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, and Curb Your Enthusiasm. But Seinfeld fans will always remember him for playing John Grossbart in the classic season 4 episode, The Airport, and we're so glad he can join us today. Thank you for being with us, Alan.
Well, it's my honor and my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you're so welcome. The honor and pleasure is all ours. I mean, John Grossbart is honestly a legendary Seinfeld character. Everybody knows John Grossbart. Such a great episode, such great scenes. So we can't wait to talk to you about it. So take us back to that time. How did the role on Seinfeld first come about?
Well, I got submitted by my agent and jumped in my car. We still had in-person auditions back then. It was 1992. And I shot over to a CBS Rad. He was either CBS Radford or Mary Tyler Moore Studios at the time over there. And I auditioned, and I walked into the room. Jerry and a few other people were looking out the window, and there's so many beautiful women walking around. I figured they were looking at a gorgeous young actress. So I look at them looking at like a classic car, and I didn't know these guys. I looked at them and said, "Guys, really? This is what you get up for?" And that kind of got me right in the zone of just being myself. And I auditioned very simply and very realistically and just as monotone as I can make it. There's a guy on a plane who some crazy guy from the past is approaching him. And you can barely get your thoughts together when someone comes out of the blue like that. So it was a really great audition. I felt very good about it. I was really happy they cast me. And not surprised, because I felt they did really, really simple, simple work. So that's it. And then it got me the gig.
Was that the first time you auditioned for the show?
First and only time, yeah. So I was lucky. I know a lot of friends of mine go to shows like that and audition 10 times before they got cast. But this one, I was just, I had wire-rimmed glasses at the time. I kind of looked like every Jew from the Upper West Side all lived there, you know. so that was just good fortune, and once in a while you're the guy, you know, without having to do much about it. So that was really great.
Absolutely. And this episode was right around the time where Seinfeld first started getting popular. You know, there was a lot of buzz around the show. So what was the vibe like on the set when you first got there?
Really nice. Really nice. My wife at the time, my first wife, Alexis Genia, was a wonderful actress, and she used to do get together with Larry and read some of his sketches with some other actress friends. So I mentioned him and said, "Hey, my wife is Alexis Genia." He lit up. He really liked it at the time, and so that was a nice thing. So he was very warm, and I also recognized him. We lived in the same building for years, I was in Manhattan Plaza from 82 to 87. I see this guy all the time. And sometimes they get in the elevator. We never said hello or anything. He had big, wild hair at the time. And he kind of was so strange looking because he kind of looked like my father with crazy hair. So I always just go back to my part and think, that guy, that's what my father must have looked like years ago, except for the crazy hair. So we never spoke. We weren't rude or anything. It's just like it's a big building, you know, 40-something floors. You get in the elevator. You want to get to your apartment. But I did recognize him from living there. And I also recognized the original, the real Kramer lived in my building there too, Kenny Kramer. So it was kind of a cool thing. It was kind of serendipitous in a way, you know, just a lot of crossing of paths that finally merged years later in Los Angeles.
Yeah. What are the odds that you play a character that Kramer used to live with? Meanwhile, you used to live in the same building as the real Kenny Kramer back in New York.
Oh, yeah. There's thousands of people in that building. All in the dark. But yes, that's true. The world gets smaller and smaller by the moment.
It's true. And we read that it only took 3 days to shoot this episode. So what was your schedule like that week? Were you there the entire time?
No, I was just there for one day. I really have two short scenes. One when he recognizes me in the airport when I'm checking the flight schedule, and then comes over to me in the seat. And the set was a real cutout from a real airplane. It was really a lot of fun. There was a lot of terrific people on that episode too. I think the best fun for me was that Michael wanted to rehearse just he and I. He wanted to rehearse getting his hand into my pocket and trying to get the money out of my pocket without us having to rehearse it on the set, so that we had it smooth. So we went off together, no director, the two of us worked together, which I love that, so that when it came to execute that business, it was smooth and the shot didn't take long at all. So he was a true actor's actor. And the last thing I saw him do before I left was him coming down the baggage chute, like there's a sliding pond. And I turned to somebody and said, and this is 32 years ago, I turned to someone and said, "This is going to be a classic episode." When I saw him do that, and fortunately I was right. Not that I'm brilliant or anything, I just got lucky with a good guess. And it's been a classic. people know it. My God, I'm turning 72. I shot that when I was 40. People still remember. The only sad part is when I watch it now, I had hair and I had black hair, like you guys have now. You know, years ago, I went to the Museum of Broadcasting to watch some Jackie Gleason episodes. This is like in the 80s. And I looked around, there's a couple of guys I recognized who had been on the Jackie Gleason show when they were younger. And today I feel like those guys, you know. It was 1985, they were watching themselves from 1955. So for me, it's 2024, and I still watch myself from 1992, which is, it's cool. I'm very happy about it. You know, after I shot it, then I shot The Sopranos a few years later. My nephews from New Jersey called me and said, "Uncle Al, you're immortal now. Seinfeld and Sopranos, you're immortal." I said, "Okay, good. I can die a happy man someday. I'll be remembered."
Seriously. What else do you need on your resume?
And also, getting back to your scenes, you mentioned that you rehearsed with Michael. Did you guys go on the plane set by yourself and rehearse that stuff, or did you go in his dressing room?
No, we just went to another part of the studio where there were no people. We set up a couple of chairs, and we went through the blocking, and you know, so that when he did it, I would, you know, resist, and so it would go real smooth and fast. So we didn't have to sit on the plane and fuck it up at that time. He's as you can see from his work, he's a acrobatic. I mean, he's really a technician of physical comedy. I mean, it's just, he was brilliant. I am sorry that he got into trouble with that stupid thing later on at the Laugh Factory, because he was just marvelous on that. You know, I think the only other guy know that close to that, like Bill Irwin. You know, Michael Rich is really like a top-notch clown and a wonderful actor. So it was just great. I still watch it today, and I'm proud of the work all those years later.
Absolutely. And you mentioned being on the set for that classic scene when Kramer comes out of the luggage chute. Is there anything else you could tell us about being on the set for that scene, like how much Michael rehearsed it ahead of time, or if they shot multiple takes of that?
I swear they knocked it out in like two quick shots. It was just him and the cameraman. I just happened to be walking through, so I stood and watched it. There was nobody else around. It was boom, boom, boom. I think maybe they did it twice. But when, you know, I think they're the kind of person that when you get it, move on. It's always wonderful to work on a set like that. You know, when you've got it, don't worry about it. You've got it. It's in the can. You don't have to do it 10 times. So that was very cool. They were very expeditious that way.
And even though you didn't have any dialogue with him, Jason Alexander was also in those scenes with you. So what was your experience like working with him?
Well, Jason is very friendly. We both went to Boston University. I'm older than him, so I was ahead of him there. And but he did come over to warn me. He said, he goes, "Watch out for him. He goes ape shit." So he said to me about, you know, physical comedy. No, I think, was he messing around with me a little bit? He may, but I really laughed hard. I thought that was very funny. No, I grew up in the Bronx. I heard the word apeshit a long time, so it really made me laugh. But he was sweet. And I didn't really have much to do with Julia, but strangely, later in life, I ended up doing three different shows with her. So, you know, Seinfeld really opened up a lot of opportunities for me. It's probably how I got on Curb Your Enthusiasm. Seinfeld was real. Was a gateway drug. it was a terrific one.
In the best possible way.
In the best possible way. Thank you.
And outside of Michael and Jason, did you get to spend time with anyone else on the set that day?
No, I think I just said hello and I got a warm hello back, but no conversation. And there were some great actors on the comedic actors. Jim J. Bullock was on there. Boy, what a terrific actor. He was a great comedian. I got to know him a little bit socially. Just all these, one great character after another. I mean, in one episode, Annie Corzin. I mean, you got so many incredible people on there. You know, I don't know if you'll ever get a sitcom again that is so character actor friendly. You know, I don't see them. I mean, and even though it was in L.A., it really felt like you were in New York. They really got the flavor of New York people, which I thought was great.
Yeah, and you mentioned Annie. She was... We had her on as well. She was fantastic.
Oh, I know her. Also, I know Annie, but God, since like 1978. I know her a long time through a theater on 18th, Off Century Theater on 18th Street. Her friends Abby and Tony ran that place, and I got to know Annie and Benny. You know, it's a small world. Everybody gets to know you. Stick around enough, you don't get to know a lot of people. Which is a pleasure. It really is.
We kind of talked about it a little bit. You're talking about the plane set there. So there's that great scene when Kramer confronts you on the plane about the money.
Right.
And obviously Jason gave you fair warning. So what do you remember about filming that scene with Michael?
It was just such fun. I had, I have to play it real straight. And I really felt like I just have to be dumbfounded in a way. Like, who is this guy? And I kept my reactions real small because I wanted to keep it very real. If somebody comes and says, yeah, do I know you? I don't know. I really wanted to do as little acting as possible. I just wanted to live off him. But there was no reason for me to be big. That was his department. Only at the end when he starts to rifle my chest and I go, hey. And I let my voice go up a couple of octaves, like in a higher, less than masculine panic. You know, the guy's really. I mean, it wasn't quite. What was the film? It wasn't Deliverance. You know what I mean? But it was
right.
I did do my own version of squealing, though, I must say. None of that was planned, and they really they left us alone. They didn't give us a whole lot of direction how to do it. The other thing I say about the show is everything I did, they trusted me, and as long as I was in the right camera angles for them, and they could hear me and see me and hit the right marks, it was golden. I was, you know, Tom Sharon, as I believe, was the director, and I remember just being really laissez-faire. I felt like this is a director that likes and trusts actors, and you can only do great work under those circumstances. No matter, you know, and also, as you well know, the material on that show is just so, so wonderful. You know, it's always, it's a show about nothing, but it was a show about everything. That's what I loved about it. There wasn't any topic or any area that it didn't visit. And in a way, like, you know, I mean, it really, I felt the change sitcom, I won't go on and on, but that was what I got out of it. Because I grew up with the Dick Van Dyke Show and all those great 50s and 60s shows, but this was different. And this took more risks. And even what seemed risky back then is like, you know, nothing today. But, you know, some of the things that they responded to and talked about in 1992, 93, 96 were daring and cutting edge. Now they're not, because of course the world changed in 32 years, but they were really they really forged some new territory for sitcom, and that was, I was very thrilled to be part of that.
Absolutely, yeah, they were pioneers for sure.
Yeah, pioneers. Thank you.
And we never find out for sure if you're really John Grossbard. So, what was your take on the character, and how did that factor into how you played the role?
Totally John Grossbard, and totally beat him for the rent. You know, he busted me. And I don't think he ever says my name to me in any of the scenes. He does, you know, chant and declare that Grossbard something. Everybody does that line except me. Grossbard, the clock tolls for you or something like that.
Listen to the bell, Grossbard. It tolls for thee.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, but he never says my name when we're on the plane. I don't think. I'm pretty sure he doesn't. But I got popped. Because that happens, you know, when you screw people over, you know, it always catches up to you in one way or another. It's not worth it. So my advice is do little or none of it.
True. And it's funny you mentioned that. It's true. He never really does say your name. All he does is that weird thing where he like cinches up his collar and he pulls his hair back. Right. 20 years ago, huh?
I swear, when he does that profile, he looks like Bowser from Sha Na Na. He does that, you know. That kind of mug, and he puts his hair back. It's very funny. And it was great. You know, the wonderful thing is that when you're working with good people and good material, you want to stay concentrated because there's a part of me that, of course, is enjoying it and wants to laugh as well. But that's not my job. My job is to do that later on. So I played it for real. You know, I played it for real. The role that was written for me was not written like a sitcom role. It was written like a straight film or TV role. And then I get upset when someone's rifling my pants. And then maybe that's a little, that's not as big as I got. So it was a great, as a young actor, it was a great lesson for me. You always say about less is more. And in that case, less is more really paid off for me because your people remember it decades later.
Definitely.
But that show had some of the best sitcom guest stars I've ever seen anywhere. Philip Baker Hall. I mean, oh my God. That could be one of the best sitcom guest stars in history. And I got to work with Phil years ago in the Los Angeles Theater Center. So watching it was just a joke. I still watch that one. I mean, I'm like everybody else. I go back and I watch some favorite ones too. You know, I go back to old series that I've seen, and I'm embarrassed to say sometimes I'm going through my third entire pass, you know, and there's so much new stuff and so much new content. But then when I want comfort food, I go back to Seinfeld. I go back to Sopranos. I go back to Curb. I go back to stuff where I can just, you know, turn my brain off and just sit back and enjoy and absorb.
I'm totally with you there. That's what I do, is I just rewatch stuff over and over, and especially Seinfeld is so deep. There's so much there. There's such a richness to it. You can watch it. I mean, Eric and I have probably watched these episodes literally thousands of times. I mean, it's ridiculous. But you find something new every time.
Yeah,
that's how it is. It's like you can watch, and the 1,001 time is when you find that one thing. You said, "Oh man, I just got that joke, or I just connected that, or I just saw that in the background."
I know clips from YouTube pop up on Facebook a lot, and I'll turn them on and go, "God, I know I've seen this, but I don't remember this and how wonderful it is." And then it forces me, to, of course, want to go back and watch the whole thing again. And I hate this. You know, I am an actor who doesn't mind making commercials. Well, I don't enjoy watching it. Unless they're really funny, like some of the Super Bowl ones. So, but I know I must really love Seinfeld because I will force myself to watch it even when there's commercials. You know, I'll suffer for the next 90 seconds because I know they're coming back with something great right afterwards.
Well, getting back to if you were the real John Grossbard, your name is Grossbard in the credits. So I just wanted to point that out.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So I was. Thank you. Yeah. Well, finally, 30 years later, that got cleared up for 100% now.
And by the way, those scenes in the airport and also on the plane, were those filmed on the same stage where they have like Jerry's apartment and the coffee shop, or was that a different location? Oh,
everything in the studio. And that's, to their credit, their sets are incredible. The cut out of the airplane is incredible. The gift shop looks like you're really in a gift shop. I mean, really, they had some of the... I don't know who designed the sets on that show, but everybody did a fantastic job. When you're on a set like that, you work better because you feel like your imaginary circumstances are really fulfilled in a real place. I was recording years ago on West Wing, and West Wing set was totally the White House. You go in there, except for the lights, you actually feel like you're in the White House. So when you're playing somebody from the Senate or something like that, it's easy to work in that kind of environment. Environment is the key word. You give an actor a good environment, they'll become a different version of themselves or a new person for you because they believe it. You know, we believe who we are when we're in an environment. And that's a great thing. Very fortunate.
And getting back to Seinfeld, do you have a favorite memory or story from your time on the show?
That's a great question. I don't know. I think just the interaction with Michael on the plane was great because we rehearsed together. So we really had it down mechanically really well. So it went smoothly and it looked very moment to moment. And we made it look like it was happening for the first time. I mean, that's the thing. You take a moment and you rehearse it, then you make it look like you succeeded in making something that came from unnatural rehearsal to looking very natural. Like, and that's the gift. So if you can make something look like it's really happening for the first time and it hasn't been rehearsed and not even acting, then it's just kind of, it thrills you. It really thrills you. You get excited, you know. So to have the panic sound, to bring up that sound was not difficult because my adrenaline was up as he's pressing me and getting closer to me and being weird, you know. And I got to behave in a way as if I would if some strange dude or someone I think I know perhaps came up to me on it. In fact, I don't think I was Grossbard, but I did not play that I recognized him on the plane. The only time I thought I had a hint of recognition was in the gift shop. There was just something about him, but I didn't look at him and go, this is my old roommate and I'm guilty. And I played it on the plane, but I don't remember this guy. I don't remember this guy. And I don't remember ripping somebody off of the rent. I don't remember him, who he is. I never look at him and go, oh, Kramer, none of that. Like, who is, I don't know who this is. But again, the only inkling was in the gift shop where I saw this guy and looked at him for a second. Just like you go somewhere and you see somebody, you think you may know them, and then you move on to your business. That I felt that was enough. It kept it simpler and kept it, it was easier to panic more under those circumstances, especially on an airplane. Of course, we didn't have the terrible terrorism problems back in 1992 we have now. But airplanes were still, you know, airplanes were still, even back then, we have weird encounters with people who have been drinking too much or getting too aggressive or, you know, pushing your arm over so they can get the armrest. So then have the woman who's playing my wife. So, and that was really helped me create a reality that it's someone to take care of. All I remember about her, she was about to get married. She was a very nice person. He was a very, very religious woman. I think we talked a little bit, but that's about all I remember. I'm sorry. It's been a while.
Oh, you've given us some great stuff so far. This is great.
Oh, I'm glad. I'm happy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really love to hear that Michael Richards rehearsed with you because, you know, you don't hear that about a lot of shows. Like actors, like the lead actors in the show is like taking the guest stars and working with them and making sure they get the best possible scene, you know?
That is the only time in my career that has ever happened. And that's why I'm very grateful to him and respect him. And sorry for the trouble he's gotten into because I wish he was still active because he's just so interesting.
And then we talked about it a little bit earlier, but a few years later, you worked with Larry David again in Curb Your Enthusiasm. And you were in a couple of episodes of that show. First, the special, which was technically, I guess, the first episode of the mockumentary. And then you came back in season two, again, as the HBO executive.
Right.
So we'd love to hear how that role came about and just what your experience was like working on that show.
Well, Curb was a result of Jeff Garlin and I met on the set of a film called Little Big League in 1993. We were out in Edina, Minnesota, which is just a suburb right outside of Minneapolis. We had hotels in Minneapolis, and we actually opened that film. He plays a Little League coach, I play a Little League umpire, and the film is about a kid who inherits the Minnesota Twins. But they did not get to, we were there 6 days, and they didn't get to us till the very last day. And we got, and this is all those years ago, we got like a great paycheck, plus a per diem of about an envelope every day of $250 cash. And in 1992, I couldn't spend $250 in Minneapolis in the days. We we went to something, you know, Jeff and I didn't necessarily hang together, but we went to a, we did a few things together, got to know each other and talked a lot. He was, I think, about to get married at the time. He told me about his experiences in Second City. And then we went out a few times between 1993 and 1999. Then I did a play in West Hollywood in 1998 by Michael Patrick King, who's one of the writers of Sex and the City. And I've done a lot of plays for him. And I did this play where I played an agent to a guy who's coming out as gay and invites Jesus Christ to Orso to tell Jesus. It's great. It was me and Chris Sarandon and Don Berman and Amy Queen. It was a great play. And Jeff saw it, loved it. And I think that seeing me in that play in the summer of 98 is how he envisioned me playing an exec. Because the role I played in that play was based on Ari Emanuel, who was a super agent, brother of Ron Emanuel, son of Dr. Emanuel. So but that didn't get me the role. I had to go in and improv with Larry and Jeff and Jeff's wife, the casting director, Marla, at the time. And I was in that room, I think, a good 30 minutes. That was, you know, a lot of improv. 30 minutes alone, but I loved it, and I kept it alive. And then I booked it. And then we did the pilot, Judy Toll and I, who was a wonderful comedian, died of cancer, unfortunately. And then they didn't have us back till 2002, where we did the shrimp incident. And that's another one that, oh my God, still people this day ask me, did you steal the shrimp? You know, sometimes I answer them, but between you and me and whoever watches this, yeah, I certainly stole. I certainly did. And lie like a dog. I mean, the reason I get so aggressive with him is because I've been busted. I've been caught. So, you know, so I doubled down with the aggression. And that was a lot of fun. And, the week before I shot that, it had been listed in the newspaper what Larry and Larry's net worth was, and I'm sure he was not happy about that. And Seinfeld, so I came up with a line and said, you know, are you a shrimp captain now? Why'd you take your $475 million and buy yourself a fucking shrimp boat? And I thought that was a home run line for me, because he then got up and walked out of which is very funny, because when he was at the I was doing stand up at the Improv, but I never knew him. I was way behind him, and I was just starting. I never took off in that world. But I heard from people that if he was doing his act and it wasn't going well, up he would go and walk right off stage. And I think that's hysterical. I think that takes more balls than actually doing the act. So we did that. I know Improv that. I see, this is what he's famous for, which is kind of true, but I think the average person would know that. That was a joy, that scene. That was one of the most fun scenes I ever shot on any show. And working in improv is the greatest. It's the greatest. You come up with stuff. You know, you're sort of on the line, and you can't play write too much. You can't TV write too much. You just have to really live off the situation. When you do that, then you discover gold, you know. And So it's been Seinfeld and Curb have been great gifts for me as an actor, just great.
How's stepfather doing?
Good.
He's doing better now, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, miraculous recovery he had, huh?
Yeah.
Good.
All right, so talk to me.
Good. We got a big show to pitch for you, big show.
All right.
Something different, something interesting, and I'm let the principals take care of it for you.
All right, well. Larry and I were talking about this concept recently, and I think it's pretty exciting. All right, you start, and then I'll, you know, do a dance and cheerlead and stuff.
How are the garlic noodles the other night?
What?
The garlic noodles.
I didn't touch your garlic noodles.
I didn't say you touched my garlic noodles. They were your garlic noodles.
Right.
But you did touch the shrimp.
What are you talking about?
I ordered Chinese food the other night. We got our orders mixed up. And when I got my order back from him, about 7 or 8 shrimp were missing.
Oh, no.
Mysteriously disappeared. Yeah, the shrimp mysteriously disappeared.
I didn't touch your shrimp.
Who gives a shit?
I don't
want to
talk about your shrimp.
I would understand that you don't want to talk about it, yeah.
Look, Larry, you got your food. I got my food.
Yeah, got your full order. I got mine minus 7 shrimp.
You counted the shrimp. You're shrimp counter now.
Well, it's pretty obvious when there's two shrimp.
Yeah. Right. Listen, Larry, I didn't touch your fucking shrimp. You know, you want shrimp? Yeah. Take your $475 million. Go buy a fucking shrimp boat.
Great. Larry, come on.
He's going to walk
Don't
out now.
Come on.
This is what he's
famous
for.
What are you doing?
Why Nothing would... changes in 25 years with this guy. Same shit.
You know?
Yeah, that scene on Curb is one of my favorite scenes of yours. And I was going to ask you if that shrimp line was your line or if Larry told you to say that. So I love that you came up with that.
I'm going to give myself credit on that one. That was me. But the thing for actors is if you're going to do improv and you're going to do something current, sometimes it may be helpful to know current events, to know what's going on. So you have something to draw from that's in the now, that's pertinent. And I just, without knowing him, when I saw that article, I think, I bet you he's pissed that somebody put his net worth. You know, for the little I know about him, I get the feeling the kind of guy that this would really irk the shit out of him. So I said, I just found a place to use that. So I wanted to go with some ammunition on him because I knew it was going to be, and one thing I did know, it was going to be a little bit of a fight. And the very first one, too, I also love that he lies to me about having a father-in-law, you know, so he doesn't have to do the show. Right. But I know I'm going too much Curb for you here. This is a show about Seinfeld. No.
We would definitely want to hear about Curb.
I don't want to mess you guys up.
No. Curb is Seinfeld's, what would you call it, a sister show, I suppose, or I don't know.
Right. They're absolutely connected. There's an umbilical cord between those two, for sure.
And speaking of both shows, Julia was also in that scene with you on Curb. So do you have any memories of working with her on that show?
I don't remember interacting much with her, just saying hello, but I worked on a couple of series with her later on and got to know her husband a little bit from parties. And I'm a jazz musician, and her husband is a jazz fan. And we talked jazz one night at a Christmas party, I think at Amy Aquino's house. And when I was on her shows, I would sit in my trailer sometimes, play my sax. And so, of course, they came over, they told me I had to stop because they could hear it. And then I showed her a very famous saxophone that I owned. And, you know, she kind of dug that. You know, she seemed like, I mean, I worked with her on two different of series. Not Veep, unfortunately. That's the one I would have loved to work on. But two of hers, and there was both times it was she and I and Steve Carell. In both those series, he played her boyfriend or love interest, and I played like the producer of her radio shows or something like that. And those shows didn't take off, but I'm surprised they were very good and they were very fun. And she was an absolute delight to audition for. When I went to audition for her show, she was so warm and welcoming and remembering me from Seinfeld and from Curb that how can you do badly when you get that kind of a warm welcome? So credit to her. She knows how to, you know, you want to get good work out of actors, make them feel welcome, make them feel comfortable, they'll deliver to you, you know. Create an environment where they feel they're wanted there, and then they'll go to the wall for you.
Ah, it's great to hear. And getting back to Curb for a second, do you have a favorite line or scene that you improvised from that show? Was it the $475 million line?
Oh, yeah, that's the one.
I also like when you say to Larry, what, you're a shrimp counter now? Or
you're a shrimp counter now? Why don't you think you're $475 million to buy yourself a fucking shrimp boat? I mean, not for me. I felt like I hit the ball out of the park on that.
Absolutely.
Sometimes in life you just get lucky. Everything synchronizes really well. You know, sometimes you find that when you're playing ball too. Once in a while, you know, someone passes you ball in the basketball court, and as soon as it leaves your fingertips and reverse spin, you know it's going in. You just know sometimes, and when that happens with acting, it's just when you just feel yourself in the right place, and you feel relaxed, and you feel inspired. And the best thing about why I love improv is improv comes from really listening to the other person. You know, I pride myself on being a pretty good improvisational actor, because that's what I really look to, listen to come up with what's next, as opposed to you're talking, I'm already planning what I'm going to say. And so I'm looking at you with those kind of eyes where you can tell I'm not really listening. I'm thinking what I'm going to say next. I trusted myself And I don't trust myself all the time. I'm like everybody else. I'm not, you know, I've got my foibles. But that day, on that episode, I trusted myself to just listen and live off what my partner gave me. And that's where the muscle came from. It was not so much like, oh, I was sitting all day waiting to say that line. That I had the information that I know I wanted to use it somewhere if I could, but I didn't plan where. It's not a script. And so the lines accrete, it also reminded me of the pilot episode where he lied to me about not doing the show. So I kind of could revisit that. We also have a scene, I think, in the Chinese restaurant where we run into each other. And that was kind of interesting. And we looked really pretty uncomfortable with one another. And that was so right. That was so right. You know, you run into somebody where you had some shit with them, and now you want to try and act like everything is okay, but you can't pull that off. Oh, no way. So I felt that was a real tension to that scene. I mean, I look at now, I'm standing there kind of rigid and unrelaxed and looking at him, and I'm deciding whether I'm going to confront them, and then, of course, I don't. So it was fun.
So in those scenes, like, I know it's improvised, but does Larry say to you, eventually in this scene, we're going to have a fight? Like, is that the way it works? But how you get there, you're not really sure?
I think that episode was either Bob Whitey or David, stand-up comic, help me, Canadian, Jewish, David.
Is it Steinberg or?
Thank you. Oh, my God. He is a real laissez-faire guy with a lot of improv experience. And I don't recall anybody saying, you know, you got to explode or anything like that. It's just that the scene is, you know, negotiation. And I think I was led to be told that, you know, that I'm not going to get what I want out of this. It's not going to be a successful deal closing scenario. So that kept it very open. And I don't remember any of the getting up being planned, me saying what I was going to say to them being planned. I don't remember we doing it too many times at all. I think we went back maybe once to do a pickup, because I see there's a bad junk there. There's one part of that shrimp and the scene where I take my glasses off, and then when it comes back, then my glasses are back on, so I know there was a cut in there. Nobody notices that except me or people who really. But you can see that was pasted together, and that they did the best they could, right? Because they wanted to get the best of the. Fortunately for me, they wanted to get the best of the acting. So you'll have to imagine that I took my glasses off when the camera was on me. I took my glasses, put my glasses back on. I mean, I bought it, but I still thought it was. So being a film person, it wasn't quite jumping the shark or. But it was. Having studied film and taken film directing classes. It was a little like I said, oh, I hope people don't really pick up on it. But I've forgiven myself. I've forgiven them myself for it. Whatever it is, it looks great now. I dig it. You know, it's just great.
Yeah. And you also came back in the finale of that season when Larry's standing outside the restaurant and he has the sign that he steals forks from restaurants.
That's right. That was such an easy day. So it was fun. I remember I was hanging out with Judy Toll and I think Sam Pancake. There were other actors, and we just really didn't have that much to do. You know, we only have to really kind of go out, leave the building, and give them the stink eye. It was a hotel on the west side, a real nice one, which I can't remember the name of, near UCLA, which I used to know the name of it. But that was a really easy day and fun. And you know, you get paid as much that day as you would on a day when you're very busy. So once in a while, those are really kind of rewarding. That was a fun day.
Did you attend the rap parties for either Seinfeld or Curb?
I have never gone to a Curb rap party, I don't think. I went to one Seinfeld rap party years ago. It was out, I think, in Malibu. And they wanted us to dress Western style. I think it was, what's her name? What's the woman who played Larry's wife, the actress who just married RFK Jr.?
Oh, Cheryl Hines.
Yeah. I think it was her idea that we do Western. And I think, if I remember, I think Larry King refused to wear any kind of Western garb, which I thought, oh, that's an episode right there. That was fun. It was a nice party. And, a whole season of people. You know how many wonderful character actors were on that show. So that was the only one I think I ever went to.
Wait, Cheryl Hines did the party for Seinfeld?
No, I'm sorry. No, for Curb.
Oh, okay.
It was a Curb party. I'm sorry. No, I never went to any Seinfeld parties. I worked on Seinfeld one day and, made history, and then that was it. It's okay. I still get people texting me some minute watching, but it's very flattering.
Really. Yeah, I was going to ask you, you have any interesting Seinfeld fan encounters or anything like that?
I've had people, write my manager, and then they'll send a card for me to autograph and send back to them. So it's great. They don't know my address. And then I had a company contact me, and they had cards. It said, have John Grossbart on there, Alan Wasserman. And I signed about 1,000 of them. Not 1,000, 100 of them. They gave me $1,000. That was what it was. So I spent one day with my flare pen, knocked it out, put it back in the envelope, and they sell them. I mean, I'm shocked that anybody would want to buy something like that, but what do I know? I guess, people did. Hopefully they sold them all.
I would love to have a John Grossbart signed card from you.
Well, yeah. All right. This is my last one. I don't really need to hold on to it. So you'll email me your address, and I'll send you the last one.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
No, I don't need it. I remember what I look like. I don't even like looking at this thing anymore because it reminds me of what I used to look like.
That's great. I love that people want that and that they're so enthusiastic about it and love your character so much. It's so great.
It's great.
And before we move on to our final segment, is there anything we didn't ask you or any other stories you'd like to share with us from either Seinfeld or Curb?
No, I think we covered it pretty well. I think we covered all the bases on that. If something occurs to me before we sign off, I don't think so. I think we've been around the bases on it really well.
All right, great. That's what we like to hear. So before we let you go, we're just going to move on to our final segment. It's called This, That, and the Other. So basically, we just ask you a question, and the first thing that comes to mind, you let us know.
Okay.
So first question, what is your favorite film?
I don't know if I have a favorite, but I love On the Waterfront.
Yeah, we've heard that one before. Great one.
Oh, yeah. Classic. Favorite band or musician?
Oh, boy. Charlie Parker.
Oh, nice.
Bird Parker, yeah. Because I pay out Barry Sachs, so yes. So I study his stuff all the time. I put his stuff on YouTube and try to play along. Things that he could do in 1946, I can barely do in 2024, but I keep fighting the good fight. So yes, Charlie Bird Parker.
What role or performance are you proudest of?
I think it's probably Curb. Yeah, I think Curb. Yeah. Also, there's two. That and also I played Michael's boss on The Office. Nick something or other.
Yeah, Nick Figueroa. We were actually going to ask.
You're great. Yeah, Nick Figueroa. That those two, I'd say. I wish I could sing one, but those two both I adored playing them.
What was it about that role in The Office that you enjoyed so much?
It was just I have been an office manager in an investment firm, so I all those things I say on that episode, I have said stuff like that to people. I had an office in Pasadena. I had 35 brokers working for me. I would have to go and get them to stop staring at the secretary or stop talking, get back on the phone because they were there to make money and I was getting a piece of their action. So all the things I said and teaching people how to sell on the phone, I've done all of that. I would read the script and go, I felt like I wrote it for myself. And I think it was Paul Lieberstein directed me. He was also a music guy as well. And he gave me a big leash. I mean, he didn't give me a lot of heavy direction. I knew how to play this guy. And Steve Carell was just really easy to play off of. We didn't have any personal conversations. You know, we didn't get to know each other. And we worked together probably three times, twice with Julie Louis-Dreyfus and once on that. And, you know, when you work with someone like that who's got the weight of the whole series on their shoulders, I don't need to get them to be my friend or know about them. If they're the kind of person that I sense is open to that and wants that conversation, I had the feeling with him that he was a nice guy that probably be preferred to be left alone. So I honored that. It was, you know, I didn't need, but when the camera rolled, we really did some great work in that scene together. A lot of fun. And all the day players who were in the office, I mean, they were all so, even when they have one or two lines, I mean, they created such a reality. Like when I'm giving the sales teaching pitch with the blackboard, I mean, they were all improvising, reacting to me and rolling their eyes. It was like, really, it was like being a substitute teacher. I mean, they helped really create a beautiful reality. So that was a great, we shot that in the basement of the old LA Times building, I think over a weekend. I think we shot everything in 2 days on Saturday and Sunday. And this is when downtown LA still wasn't quite so gentrified yet. There was a lot of poor, crazy people running. This is 2007 we shot that. That was a lot. But it was a lot of fun. I'm very proud of that one. And I get recognized by people, the one-third my age, you know, all these years later. I mean, look how many years later. It's 17 years ago. People still look. I'm surprised they look at me and recognize me because I, you know, at 71, I don't quite look like what I looked like then. I wish I did. So I'm honored that they still pick me out of a lineup. It's kind of nice.
Yeah, honestly, you do such a great job with that's such a great episode of that show, and you do such a great job with that scene. And I got into the office after I got into Seinfeld, and when I found out that it was the John Grossbard playing Nick Figaro, I was like, oh man, that's such a great connection.
I've been blessed with those kind of guys. They're kind of related in a way. It's the I usually play the kind of executive you can tell did not come from Beverly Hills. You know, I'm from the Bronx originally, and I think I try to exude my urban roots in these things that I play. I mean, a lot of the people I grew up with still talk with the heaviest of New York guys. And when I grew up in a place, I say, once you shut the door, you're coming all the way. How you doing? And that's great for certain roles, but I've had to learn to speak, you know, Atlantic speech and. But people pretty much, New York's unfortunately still in, always in the music of my voice. I get busted on a regular basis.
The role you didn't get, but you really wanted.
There was a role that I was read for The Wizard of Oz, where De Niro played Bernie Madoff, that Barry Levinson directed. They kept me on hold for about 4 months, and I was playing auditioning for I think either for his brother, or for De Niro's brother, and also for an attorney. But I'm so proud of the work. I have kept the audition reel on my computer, and it broke my heart that I didn't get it. And I got a nice Barry Levinson's office called my agent to apologize, say how much they liked me, that didn't go my way. But you know, they did hold me for 4 months. I thought I had the job, and until you step foot on that set, you ain't got the job. So I knew that I might not get. I mean, I didn't think, oh, I got this, but I was thinking, I hope I got it. At least I'm closer to not getting it than other people who read for it. That one broke my heart. I would have loved to have been in that. And if I had these scenes with that, because I did read for another one wasn't a big role, but I read for Casino to play an attorney for De Niro in Casino. But they cast the actual mayor of Las Vegas, and I thought, well, you know, he's probably giving him all sorts of deals for shooting, so he probably
exactly.
And it was great because that was a scene that I auditioned with De Niro and Scorsese, just the three of us in a room. And after the dialogue was over, I started to improv with De Niro, and he went with it. And I thought, oh, shit, I'm good again.
Wow.
And I was also, I mean, this guy, also when I walked in, I was surprised at how physically small they both were. I mean, Scorsese is tiny. De Niro's not a big guy either. You know, I was kind of looking down on him because I'm also in awe of his work. I was like the biggest tough guy. But he's a little bantam rooster kind of guy. If you see his latest film, he now he's looking like Harry Truman these days. what an actor, you know, what a great actor.
That's funny.
Favorite story working on the set of a film or TV show?
Unfortunately, I got, I was in Hannah and Her Sisters. I played Woody Allen's accountant, which unfortunately I got cut. I didn't get into the film. And it was explained to me that the storyline with he and the accountant was really peripheral to everything else that was going on. But I didn't have to audition. Julia Taylor, the casting director, sent me in there. This is 1985 and in New York. And I walked in, I looked at him, and he looked at me and goes, "You look like an accountant." That was it. I got the job. And then I'm sometimes a bit of a nervous New York fast talker. And he liked that part of me. And so I did one take where we're talking, we're leaving a building, walking up 61st Street. And then the next time, you know, I'm a young actor of 33, I'm thinking, well, maybe I should take a little time in between my lines, you know, let some air come in. I do that. And after with that shot, Woody turned to me and said, "Now, if you do it like that, people are going to go streaming up the aisles." So he says, "Look, I hired you because you're a fast talker, and that's what I want." I said, "You forget those pauses. Let's do it again." And then I gave it to him. Unfortunately, it didn't make it in there, but that was one of my earliest films, a second. I think it could have been the first feature film I did. But then after that, I had some good shots with I was in Big and in something you've never seen called Luckiest Man in the World with Phil Bosco. So I that's the reason I came out here, because I started doing films in the mid-80s, and I thought, New York's not the place to stay if you do films. Now it is. Now they do a lot more there. But in the mid-80s, it's like you get the occasional film and then maybe Law and Order, and then that was it, or soap operas. Now it's much more of a working film city than it was in 30 years ago, 35 years ago.
Yeah, you mentioned Big. Any stories you have from working on that film? Did you get to spend any time with Tom Hanks or anything like that?
Yes, but that didn't go well. But I what did go well is I went to meet with Penny Marshall on her office in 57th Street. Again, improv came in and saved the day. Walked in there and started talking a little bit. She was from Marshall Parkway in the Bronx. I'm from Pelham Parkway. She instantly liked me from that. And then I improv as the gym teacher, the basketball, been doing the basketball. So then I got cast. And at the time I was living in Weehawken, New Jersey. So I had this pop, where they shot my scene in a junior high school in New Jersey. I had this pop in my car and I was at the set in 20 minutes. And she just let me do it. She just told me basically, you know, the period is ending. You got to get these kids back into the locker room, you know, tell them to clean up their act. So I came up with stuff like, you know, remember to wash your shirts and shoes, wash those jocks, you know, practice your layups, you know, I mean, what a gym teacher would scream at people. So, and then after we did some takes, she said, "I'm going to break for lunch." She goes, "Now, if you want, Alan, there's some guys here from the Bronx who are going to be playing basketball." So instead of having lunch, I played half court basketball with the crew, which was fun. So like when I did the scene again, I was like so relaxed. You know, in my body, because you know what it is to play half court basketball. You know, you're moving every second. So she was really she gave me lots of hugs on the set. She made me feel so loved. I adored her. She was so pretty then, and just the sweetest person. That was a really great experience. But with Hanks, I saw him and I was about wrapped, and I just went over to him as leave and said, "Hey, I just want to wish you luck on this." And he kind of looked at me and then looked away. And I thought, what an asshole. I don't know if you want to put that in or not. But he's probably a great guy. Maybe I caught him on a bad day. But, you know, I never got shined on like that by anybody. I mean, you wish somebody good luck. You stick out your hand and they turn away like you've got, you know. I had another friend who was on another film where he had a similar experience with him like that. Now, he was younger, maybe insecure, maybe his mind was somewhere else. I mean, I can give you a million reasons why he did it, but I didn't dig it, you know. And so maybe and people who work with him since tell me that he's wonderful, this and that. So maybe with success and maturity, But if somebody came over to me and said good luck on it, I wouldn't like give them like, thank you. Simple thank you. You know, acknowledge the existence. So there's been very little of those incidents for me, though. Very few. I think that when they're lousy like that, they stick out and they, you know. And
of course.
And I love, by the way, that doesn't stop me from loving his work, by the way. I'm able to separate the art from the artist. I know, I'm films like Philadelphia and so many of his films. He recently, I think he did Henry V on stage in here in L.A. So I don't discredit his talent whatsoever. It's just that one encounter was not, didn't sit well with me.
And finally, we have to ask you about the legendary Sopranos. I know you kind of talked about it being in it earlier, but do you have any stories about being on that show, working with Dominic Chianese, anything?
That was it was a dream working with him. It was so easy to work with. And I reminded him, I had met him. I auditioned for my first TV pilot in 1982. I was 30. In New York for CBS big, I was for a big show. And I was the kind of guy at the time with the big Jufro, big curly hair. And I'm like, I kind of look like Avery Schreiber back then. That was the look, you know, big funky hair. And when I got to the waiting room, I had an anxiety attack. I really was imploding. I think, oh God, I can't do this. And it was just Dominic and I in the waiting room because he was going in after me to play, you know, I'm there with Johnny Ola, you know, that's who was known for at the time. He said, "Get kid, are you all right?" I go, "I don't know. I'm just having feeling like they're not gonna like me, and I talk too fast. I'm too New York, and I'm just." He said, "Hey, you just go in there and be yourself, and that's all you need to do." And I dropped all my anxiety and all beating up. I went in there. And I didn't get the role, but I did really well. I was relaxed. I was alive. I was living off the reader. I mean. I didn't end up being the guy, but I walked away with my head held high, and it was because Dominic was there to coach me. And so I reminded him of that. And I said, "No, you met me. I was a young, nervous Jewish kid." He goes, "Oh, I'm married to a woman like that." Well, that was a very funny line. I also know that he was also a musician. He used to play at the village gate. He played Italian folk songs on guitar, which they finally used in The Sopranos later. In the series. So yeah. I liked him a lot. Right? It was a pleasure to be around him. And we shot in a school in Belleville, New Jersey. We had these simple trailers, and it was real easy. They pick you up in Manhattan, they take you out in Jersey, you hang out in your trailer. And David Nutter was a great, no, he ended up doing a lot of Game of Thrones. I think he did a lot of those. But with me, he was like a third base. He was like a baseball coach. Like he would just come in, get on his knees, and just whisper quietly in my ear. So that it was great. He gave me secrets so that the other actors don't know what I'm going to do or why I'm doing it. He was very smart and really calm. And it's a great scene. I'm really proud of the scene. Unfortunately, I couldn't come back in that one to Insides because I don't think they wanted to, fly me back and forth because I was living in L.A. In fact, when I auditioned for it, I told my wife, we went to a casting place on Cahuenga. We put it on videotape back then, and there was a FedEx next door, and a FedEx thing wasn't like these are now. And I put it to the FedEx, and I turned around and go, "Look, I ain't got a shot at this, but what the fuck?" Let me throw my – and then when I got it, I couldn't believe it, you know. So then they put me up, negotiated, gave me a certain amount of money to fly there and put myself up on the hotel. I think it was like $1,300. And I said to myself, "I'm going to do it for less, and I'm going to pocket the rest of the money," which I did. Because HBO doesn't pay that well, but they give you great, you know, the exposure is like, you know, incredible. The exposure is great. HBO has been very good to me. They put me on a lot of good shows, The Comeback and Sopranos and a few other things. And going way back to Dream On. I mean, I've had a lot of good experiences at HBO.
What's an interesting fact people might not know about you?
I played alto and baritone sax and vibraphone. I have my own jazz band in L.A. of anywhere 7 to 17 people. Jazz has been a big part of my life. I played from the age of 12 to 18 and stopped for 30 years. Picked it up in the year 2048. at the age of 48 in the year 2000, excuse me. Now it's turned 72 this year. I'm playing 24 years. I still take lessons every week with guys one third my age who are just monster good. I've got a great musical career. I love that. And the other thing, I was people don't know about me. I was a stockbroker for 30 years while I was an actor, so I didn't starve. And I would get a job somewhere. They say, "Wait, Al, are you an actor anymore?" I go, "No, I'm done with that." And then they would go to the movies. And they made some, like my manager, the first week I was at a place, like 2 months later, he goes, "Oh, you're not an actor anymore? Just took my kids to see Little Big League. I'm pretty sure that was your ass spend on her home plate." So, all right. I said, "Look, here's the thing. I'm going to go on a set and I'm going to get the gaffer and the director and the first AD is my client. You'll never get near them. I'll get you people in Hollywood that want to invest their money and they trust me because I'm in the business. They'll never trust you." And that turned out to be true. So then I worked my way up to being a manager. Then I owned my own shop for the last 10 years of my career. And the last 10 years of my career, I was right here in my guest house. Because before that, I rented an office for $14,000 a month, then another office for $7,000 a month. And from the year 2000 to the year 2009, I paid $1 million in rent. That could have went in my pocket. So then from 2009 to 2019, I was right here with an assistant. I sent all my brokers to work from home. And where I got comfortable financially was to work here. Suddenly had no rent and a 90% payout. And that's how I was able to. So the nice thing is when I go to audition for things now, I don't do this for the need to pay the mortgage or anything. I do this because I absolutely love it. I do a lot of dubbing. Tomorrow I've got two dubbing jobs and then I have a commercial audition and I feel like I'm still in the game. I just read for TV series. During the pandemic, I was on a series with Will Ferrell and Paul Rudd called The Shrink Next Door. Well, I got to play a rabbi who bar mitzvahed Will Ferrell. That was a tremendous scene. I was very proud of that. It's also very funny. And I didn't have to do anything to make it funny. It was just funny. And I was on Hunters where I played it. Just so I'm feeling, I know a lot of guys my age have already left the business because they couldn't stand it anymore. They couldn't financially help. For me, it's just pleasure. If I stop tomorrow, it wouldn't be about money because I just don't want to do it. As long as I get up and I want to do it, it's fun. And if it ever stops being fun, I'm done. You know, it's not a chore anymore. It's a labor of love. I really have always loved them. And I'm turning 72 in May. I've been an actor since I'm 19. So I really found something that I love.
Oh, that's great. And final thing, you might have told us already, but favorite moment of your career?
I got cast in the Broadway show, The Basic Training of Pablo Hummel with Pacino, and I was the understudy for half the male cast. And I got my equity card that way. I was on 25 years old. I was on Broadway, and as an understudy of about 7 roles, a lot of guys in that cast would get TV series or movies and leave. So I went on a lot in many different roles, really got my chops, not a lot of rehearsal as an understudy. And the beauty of an understudy is that when you go on as an understudy, you get double salary. And so it was a favored nation's contract with some guys with much bigger resumes than me. But the weeks that I go on as an understudy, the only person making more money than me was Pacino. Everybody was getting Broadway minimum, which was not a lot at the time, but when I started the show, it was $275 a week. It went up to $355 a week. Now, that doesn't sound like anything today, but I lived large on $355 a week in 1977. I lived like a kid. I mean, my rent wasn't even $200 a month. I mean, I felt like, you know, I'm rich. I saved up $5,000. I'm a rich actor now.
What was Pacino like to work with?
Great. We're both from the Bronx. And I was in a lot of understudy rehearsals. He was always very sweet to me. We played on the Broadway show league together. He was a great baseball player, a third baseman. When he was a young man, I think he could have went out to play Major League Baseball. He was that good. I mean, he's a short guy, but when you meet him, he's got a big hand. He's got the body of a big man from the waist up. He was very strong, and I didn't see him make any errors, and he grabbed that softball and whipped it to first base, and he was really good. I remember his hitting, but I do remember his fielding was really aggressive, real good. So he grew up with the name Sonny in the Bronx, which is funny because he got to play Michael, not Sonny Corleone. And he was real. And in fact, one time he said to the director after an understudy rehearsal, "Hey, can Alan go on with us tonight?" And they said, "No, he can't. He's an understudy. There's no, we can't create an extra role for him. I know you like him, but that was so flat." And then I ran into him out here. He was doing a play reading out at the Veterans Campus on the West Side. This is maybe 15 years ago. At any rate, I went backstage with my wife to introduce him. And I said, Alan Wasserman Pavlone, I still have our softball photo. And he goes, "I do too, because I look at it every day." And I said, "This is my wife, Amy." And he turned to her and goes, "Hello, sweetheart." And she melted. I mean, she was glowing all the way to the car. He was so charming to her. I was so grateful. Yeah, can't remember what play it was, but he aged to another interesting thing happened when I was on this. He was on the show Hunters that I was on. And so I was on the set, but I didn't have any scenes with him. And then I see him. This is just about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. And I walk up and say, Alan Wasserman. And he looks at me and goes, "I'm a stand-in." And I started to look closely. I could see that it was a fake wig and a fake stomach, but you had to get to be about 18 inches away to realize it wasn't Al. This guy, this stand-in was like, if he walked down the street, people would be chasing him to the car. It was so funny. So holy, I thought cow. I could do it again, but unfortunately I did not. It was a stand-in. That was great.
Well, Alan, thank you so much for doing this. I mean, like I mentioned earlier, you've been in some of our favorite movies and TV shows, and it was such an honor that we got to talk to you about it. So thank you.
Right back at you. I'm very grateful for this. I really had a great time. I was really looking forward to it. I hope I haven't bored you to death.
No, not at all. You gave us such great stuff, and thank you so much. And of course, for your Seinfeld role, you did such a great job. Thank you. It's a classic episode. And again, Don Grossbart is a Seinfeld legend, and you really, truly are such an icon in Seinfeld history. So we thank you so much for talking about it.
Well, God bless Jerry Seinfeld. God bless Larry David, because both those shows, I'm getting residual checks for decades now. And it's funny money, and I'm very grateful for it.
Well, it's well deserved. And we thank you again for all the laughs, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your night. Take care.
Brother, God bless. Be well.
Thanks. God bless. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode. If you have any questions or comments, please feel free to email us at theplacetobeseinfeld@gmail.com. You can also find our show on Facebook at The Place to Be, a Seinfeld podcast, Twitter at TPTBSeinfeld, and Instagram at theplacetobe.podcast. You can find our show on Anchor, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Breaker, Pocket Casts, Radio Public, and Apple Podcasts. And if you'd like, please rate and review. It really helps us out. Until next time, be sure to hang up your pants for the perfect crease.
Well, you're not going to believe it.
What?
The plane's been rerouted back to Kennedy. We got 45 minutes.
Let's go.
Listen to the bell, Grossbart. It tolls for thee.